Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of judgment is required to help us do the right thing? Are strict moral codes and rules enough to ensure that we make wise and humane decisions? Or do we also have to consider whatever special circumstances exist at the time and place we make our choices? Barry Schwartz is professor of social theory and social action, specializing in psychology and economics at Swarthmore College. His new book, written with Kenneth Sharp, is called Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. Barry, welcome to Think.
Well, it's great to be with you, Chris.
You know, what I love about this book is that you remind us here that while wisdom may be precious, it's not necessarily a rare commodity. We all have within us the potential to be wise.
That's right, and that's really very important. We tend to think of wise people, mostly wise old men with long white beards sitting on tops of mountains. And the point of our book is that you need wisdom to make the most mundane everyday decisions, how to have a tough conversation with a friend, how to manage simultaneously to put your arms around your kids and make sure they're safe, and also to give them the opportunity to take risks and become independent, competent people. It's just a routine part of our day-to-day interactions with other people.
When did our concept of wisdom get sort of pushed aside by the idea that there can be a rule or a policy for every possible decision?
Well, I think that has come, that's evolved over the years. We take our cue from the ancient philosopher Aristotle, mm-hmm. who thought really that the way to do the right thing was to be a good person, to have virtuous character, and the most important virtue you needed was wisdom, precisely because you needed to make judgments on a case-by-case basis about when to be kind and when to be honest and when to be brave and when to be cautious and stuff like that. But what's happened over the years, at least in our tradition, is that notions of good character have been replaced by notions that what we need is good rules, good moral rules. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, always tell the truth and stuff like that. And so we think that if only we can come up with exactly the right rules, and then everybody follows them, we'll have a moral and a just society. It's a very nice impulse, but I think the truth is that the world is too complicated for any set of rules to do the job.
Yeah, it really is interesting when we all have to make so many decisions throughout the day. We're not necessarily, if those rules worked, maybe they would work properly. But the truth is there are times when they would obviously fail us. For example, you know, people don't always want the naked truth about, you know, how they look that day or something as simple as that.
No, actually, you know, when we teach a class on this topic to our students, we start by talking about friendship because that's something they care a lot about and know a lot about. And almost all of them think that the hallmark of a good friendship is honesty. And their understanding is you just have to be honest with your friend all the time, no matter what. And we slowly, by giving them examples, peel that away and make them appreciate that they probably tell 30 lies a day to their friends because, you know, you want to be kind, and this may not be the moment when your friend can hear the honest truth. And I think doctors face the same thing. You know, nowadays doctors are supposed to, they're not supposed to tell patients what to do. They're supposed to give patients information and let patients decide. Well, do you give your patient the brutal, honest truth about, you know, a terminal disease, or do you find some way of shading the truth so that the patient is not completely crushed and devastated and wanting to give up in that very moment? These are very hard judgments to make, but they're essential.
Can you talk about this idea that truth certainly might exist in shades of gray rather than in black and white, but it seems like modern society, we've almost been trained to reject the notion that anything that's gray instead of black or white could possibly be more true than something that's at one pole or the other.
You know, it's interesting. I think that on the one hand, we live our lives fully appreciating that almost everything is gray. The problem is that we just don't trust one another enough to allow people to use their judgment and make decisions. And so we impose, I think, a kind of black and white caricature on the world because, you know, they don't trust, you know, people won't trust me. Mm-hmm. A, that I'll use my judgment well, and that I have good judgment, and B, that I'll actually do something that is meant to serve their best interests rather than my own. So the way we protect ourselves in this, in the face of this mistrust, is we create these rules and then demand that people stick to them, knowing perfectly well that the rules actually aren't good enough.
Yeah. You know, it strikes me sometimes when I'm trying to explain something in history to my children, you know, you look at the first Thanksgiving, and were the Pilgrims and the Indians friends, or did they try to kill each other? Well, there was a little bit of both. And there's that question of like, well, were they good or were they bad? It's a very simplistic, understandable, childlike response, but we ought to expect more of ourselves.
We ought to. And I must say that this 24/7 news cycle driven by sound bites and 140-character Twitter feeds don't help either, has really sort of pushing everybody to take as unnuanced a stance toward complicated issues as they possibly can. If you can't boil it down to a sentence or a word, no one is interested. Hmm. And you know, we already have this tendency to make things simpler than they really are, but I think the modern sort of technological world we live in makes that tendency even more extreme.
The other thing that comes through here, Barry, is the idea that not only is it okay for empathy and emotion to creep into our decision making, it's imperative if we want to make wise decisions in many situations.
Exactly so. This is another misstep that that Ken Sharp and I think we've taken as a culture. People are very nervous about making decisions based on emotions. You can't trust emotions. You know, they don't last. You, in the heat of the moment, you may act rashly. They're very partial. You know, you show favoritism to people you like as opposed to people you don't. So the trick is to make your decisions with the cool eye of reason. And what we suggest is that when it comes to making decisions about other people, what you need is to think with your heart and feel with your head. That is to say, you need to find a way to integrate detachment and dispassion with a kind of empathetic understanding of what the other person is going through. And we sort of shut that empathy part down. I don't know if you remember this, but when Justice Sotomayor was being considered for the Supreme Court, she was really chastised for having made a speech a couple of years ago that talked about the importance of having people on the bench who can empathize with the parties and the cases that come before them. And she was really savaged. What do you mean empathy? It's just about applying the law. And she backed away from it because the response was so hostile. But I think she was right. And we have some cases that we describe in the book of judges using their judgment and their empathy to make extremely wise decisions in difficult criminal cases.
Let's talk about that, because there are in many places now these three strikes you're out rules and rules that essentially take away. If we think anyone in our society is pretty wise and has been elevated to a certain point, it's judges. And yet the way we've written the laws, they don't have a lot of latitude anymore, particularly when it comes to sentencing.
That's absolutely right. I mean, why do we call them judges? You know, what are judges supposed to do? They're supposed to use their judgment. And there's a case we talk about of a young man named Michael who committed an armed robbery in a taxi cab. He stole $50 from a cab driver, and he was caught, and he pled guilty, and he came before this judge, Judge Lois Forer, and the sentencing guidelines indicated that he should be sentenced to a minimum of 5 years for armed robbery in a public conveyance. But she looked at the facts of the case, and fact one, the gun was a toy. Mm-hmm. Fact two, he had just lost his job, had a wife and a kid who he was taking care of. The kid went to a parochial school, and he was in a panic that he wouldn't be able to continue to support his family. So in a rash moment, he committed this crime. He'd never committed a crime before. His record was completely clean. So she decided that no good would come of a harsh sentence, and considerable bad would happen because it would almost certainly wreck the family. So she sentenced him to a year, and in addition, he was released every day so he could go to work. So he spent his nighttime in jail and his daytime on the job. He served his time, he made restitution to the cab driver, he got out, he got a job, and it seemed like a wonderful case of a wise judge making a wise judgment. Mm-hmm. But the prosecutor was very unsettled by her willingness just to ignore the sentencing guidelines, and so he appealed the sentence. And 2 years after Michael had been released, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that he had to go back and serve out another 4 years, at which point Judge Forer, the wise judge, resigned, and Michael disappeared. So this combines both a wonderful example of a wise judge and, as you pointed out, the way in which the system crushes efforts on the part of people to use their wise judgment.
Barry Schwartz is my guest. He's professor of social theory and social action at Swarthmore College. His new book, written with Kenneth Sharp, is called Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. We'll resume our conversation with Barry in a moment and invite you now to join us on the phones, talk about your ideas of practical wisdom, perhaps your dilemmas. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Justin Martin is here now, and perhaps you have an update on how we're doing with our Wells Fargo Challenge Grant.
Yes, it looks like we have 58 calls to go to meet this challenge. That's a $1,000 challenge from the Wells Fargo Foundation. Basically, we started out needing to hear from 75 contributors before the end of Think. So far, we've got 56 to go. If that happens, it's $1,000 additional going to KERA, a large amount of money that we don't want to turn away. 1-888-694-6931. Or KERA.org.
Your money goes to the programming that you value. It goes to the fact that you can tune in to this show, which is on 4 days a week for 2 hours every day. How many times, think about this, over the past year have you thought, I've got to go right now after I get out of here and go get a copy of that book and read it? And you probably think nothing about picking up a copy of the book. This one runs about $27, and you might think, terrific, I can do that. Think about that amount when you think about making a contribution to KERA. You know, if you've bought a few books, if you've gone to a few events and spent money on that, on content that adds value to your life, KERA adds value to your life. It just doesn't come with an exact price tag. You can use your wisdom, make your own judgment about how much this is worth to you. Give us a call at 1-888-694-6931 or go to KERA.org. In order to earn this challenge grant, now we're getting down. We had plenty of time before, and now we're getting down sort of to the wire. We need 56 more calls by the end of this hour. That's only about 41 minutes. Yours right now would get us that much closer to this challenge grant. If you would like to receive a thank you gift of a copy of Practical Wisdom, I believe we have copies of that available. Nice. When you make a contribution of $120 or more, you can do that either online at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
1-888-694-6931 or KERA.org. Consider for a moment how many times you've used information that you've heard on Think Here with Chris Boyd or All Things Considered or Morning Edition when you've referenced a story that was very interesting that perhaps changed your perspective of how the world worked. This is what we do here. We want to provide you with information. We want to educate you with new topics, maybe a little entertainment thrown in on the weekend with, you know, This American Life or Prairie Home Companion. Regardless of the program that you like, your contribution goes just directly to supporting all of the programs here on KERA, and it allows not just you and your family to continue enjoying it, but maybe others in the Metroplex area. 1-888-694-6931 or KERA.org.
Big thanks to Karen Nelson and James Harrison in Sherman, Nathan Burgess in Tyler, Catherine Wingate in Dallas,
Ginger Strand in Flower Mound, Deidre and Jameson Buchanan in Garland, Kirk Sisko and Allen, and Joan Floyd in Denton.
Your contribution now at 1-888-694-6931 helps us to keep public radio strong in this community. With luck, your contribution and that of 74 other listeners will allow us to receive the $1,000 challenge grant from the Wells Fargo Foundation. You can make a contribution on the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Or go online to KERA.org. Consider receiving a copy of Practical Wisdom as your thank you gift when you make a contribution this hour of $120 or more. Thanks very much.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Barry Schwartz. He is professor of social theory and social action, specializing in psychology and economics at Swarthmore College. His new book is called Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find John in Richardson. Hello, John.
Hi. I hate to be a wet blanket, but in the case that you were just discussing of the fellow who robbed the cab driver, I have a question for your guest. If a bank robber uses a gun and the teller does not know that the gun is a toy, the teller is still terrified of the gun. And I would argue that in that particular case, the judge having sympathy for the robber is more misplaced sympathy than wisdom. I'd like to know what your guest thinks of the role of personal responsibility when it comes to wisdom. Just because the fellow didn't know what the guidelines were for sentencing, I don't think that negates the horribleness of his action. And it seems to me that there's very, very little acceptance of personal responsibility nowadays, and it seems that that should also be a big part of wisdom is knowing the implications of what your actions are on other people.
Well, I think, John, we got your point, and I think okay. It's a great one, and thank you very much for the call. We'll get a response for you.
Terrific.
What do you think, Barry?
Well, I first of all, I completely agree that it's very important for people to acknowledge that they should take and personal responsibility and are personally responsible, and I don't think that Judge Forer's sympathy for Michael and his circumstances meant that she thought he shouldn't be punished. A year in prison. What she was trying to do was to determine what kind of punishment would simultaneously serve justice, work as a deterrent, and do as little damage as possible while he was being rehabilitated. She probably imagined that a draconian sentence, a five-year sentence, would simply have ruined his life and his family's life, and it wouldn't have made the cab driver's life any better. Now, she may have been wrong. You know, the risk when you use your judgment is that you can get it wrong. It's just that when you follow rules, you're guaranteed to get it wrong. It's just that then you can blame the errors on the rules rather than on your judgment.
You know, John's point, I think, brings up the idea that we do sort of, as a society, fear the slippery slope. So let's assume, just for the sake of this argument, that the issue with Michael was the correct decision that the judge originally made. Somebody might say, well, that's such a good decision that let's make the law so that all, you know, unemployed fathers of one who hold up somebody in the back of a cab with a fake gun get this sentence. And that wouldn't work either. But we're so afraid that changing the rules once means we have to change it every time.
We're afraid that giving people permission to deviate from the rules will create this slippery slope. I agree with you completely, and some of that fear is justified.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not think about judging so much. Let's think about something that's sort of more mundane, the way teachers teach. Increasingly in the United States, teachers are being given detailed scripts that specify almost sentence by sentence how every lesson is supposed to be taught. And the scripts are sort of tailored to the kinds of things kids are going to have to show that they know when they take these huge tests that are now part of No Child Left Behind. And of course, you know, the country as a whole can thank your wonderful state for having ushered in this new mode of education. Well, so why do we give teachers these scripts to follow? Because we don't trust their judgment. We think that if we leave them to their own devices, they won't know how to do it. And we're probably right. Teachers are not very good, many of them. And so giving them scripts protects us against catastrophe. But the consequence of that is that they'll never get any better.
Hmm.
So we settle for what we know are absolutely mediocre teachers, and it's an insurance policy against disastrous teachers, and also a guarantee that the really good ones won't have a chance to develop their ability, or they'll leave the way Judge Forer did and you know, do some other kind of work. So we're very nervous that when you let people use their judgment, sometimes they'll have bad judgment.
think my favorite story, there are a lot of really interesting stories in the book that sort of stick with you, but my favorite one in the book is about a hospital custodian who, had he been following the rules, could have done his job and left and had absolutely no reason to turn back around. Will you tell that story for us?
Absolutely. It's our favorite story, too. And we tell it partly just to illustrate that wisdom is not for sages sitting on mountaintops. The story is about a custodian named Luke who worked in an academic medical center as a custodian, and his job description had 20 or 30 different tasks that he had to achieve: emptying trash cans, washing floors, restocking cabinets, stuff like that. Not a thing on the list involved interaction with another human being. He could, as we say in the book, he could have been working in a mortuary just as well as in a hospital. Mm-hmm. But that's not what Luke thought his job was. And in the example we describe, he had cleaned the room of a young man who was in a coma and had been for about 6 weeks. And the young man's father was keeping vigil in the hospital every day and obviously extremely distressed. And he hadn't seen Luke clean his son's room. So he confronted Luke angrily and said, you know, clean my son's room. And Luke's first reaction was to get angry in return, and then maybe to explain patiently and calmly, I have cleaned the room, and then maybe to get a supervisor to intervene and calm the man down. He did none of those things. What he did, and he made this decision in an instant, what he did was he said, I'm sorry, I'll get to it right now, and he cleaned the room again. And what Luke realized is not only that this was the best way to perform really a blessed act in the service of this man's distress, but it would also give the father a sense that he was actually able to make some small difference in his son's life by taking care of him. Luke thought this sort of activity, seeing to the needs of patients and their family, was an essential part of his job, although it was nowhere in his job description.
You know, what's so interesting about that story, Barry, is it also points out how dangerously siloed we have become in how specialized our jobs are these days. It seems to, you know, if you look at it from the 60,000-foot view, if you work in a hospital, your job is to help sick people and their families. But you're right. Nobody would have said to the custodian, and your job is to make sure that if someone is distressed, you do something, go out of your way, perhaps make yourself late for the next six things you have to do on that long list of tasks. But he saw that and probably is someone who likes his job because he can think of himself not simply as the guy who empties the trash can, but as the guy who's an integral part of caring for people in need.
That's absolutely true. Now, not all custodians have this view. Some of them think, you know, my job is to keep the place clean, and it doesn't take any skill to do it. You know, 10 minutes of training, and you're a hospital custodian. Others, like Luke, and Luke was not unique, think it takes a lot of training. And if you ask Luke, what do? He doesn't say, I'm a custodian. He says, I'm a hospital custodian. Hmm. And that means that he does whatever is needed to assist in the care of patients. So there are other examples of custodians who help turn patients in bed so that they don't get bed sores and the patients are too big for the nurses to manage to do the turning on their own. That's not part of their job description. But they think their job is to do whatever is needed and whatever will be helpful in the service of the mission of the hospital. And you're right, we don't see people that way. We silo them, and if we don't, their supervisors silo them. I mean, Luke was able to do this because he had the space to sort of improvise around his actual job description. If he had a supervisor looking over his shoulder and cracking the whip to make sure that he was, quote, productive, he wouldn't have been able to do things like this.
Another organization where clearly rules are very, very important and obedience is very, very important is the military. But creative leadership, and in that, I guess, practical wisdom, really matters as well, and in some cases can save lives. Will you tell us about Lieutenant Colonel Chris Hughes?
Right. So this is a story of this was in Iraq, and Hughes was leading a small a group of soldiers into a square that I think it was they were trying to maintain some control in Najaf and make contact with a leader, an Iraqi leader. And so they came into the square and they were immediately surrounded by Iraqi villagers looking extremely angry, hostile, and menacing. and it was terrifying. And what Hughes instantly said to his troops was, put down your guns and take a knee.
That's the sort of kneel down on one knee.
Kneel down, yeah. Gun facing the ground. And, you know, they looked at him like he'd lost his mind. But they did it because you learn to follow orders. And what happened was instantly the anger diffused, the crowd diffused, it broke up, and people went away. And after the fact, you know, he was asked, where did you learn to do that? And, of course, no one trained him to do that, but he was able to see that the alternatives to that were almost certainly going to lead to horrible consequences. Either, you know, shoot over their heads, and if they don't disperse, then what do? Then I guess you have to shoot them in the chest. So he thought this might work. And the question is, where do field commanders like this learn to improvise in the way that Chris Hughes did? And the answer, it looks like, is that they learn a lot of their improvisational skill while they are training their own soldiers for combat.
Which they're doing less of these days.
And that's the thing. In its infinite wisdom, the Army has transformed sort of the training regime, which might have listed 10 or 15 goals generally stated and then left it to the trainers to actually achieve these goals, now has hundreds of goals, much more specific, like a script. And the result is that these field commanders never get to improvise while they are training their troops. And the result is that when they now need to improvise on the battlefield, they don't have the resources to do it. So all these rules that the Army promulgated were designed to serve the interests of the soldiers. You know, they weren't trying to sabotage effective military training. They thought they were doing their soldiers a favor, and it turns out they weren't, because they were depriving commanders of the opportunity to learn how to make really difficult, rapid judgments.
Barry Schwartz is my guest. He's co-author of the new book, Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. We will take a quick break now, after which we will get to more of your calls at 1-800-933-5372. Want to give you an update now about the Wells Fargo Challenge. This is $1,000 that the Wells Fargo Foundation has promised to give to KERA if we can receive a total of 75 contributions during the 2 hours of Think Today. We started out needing 75 at noon, and now we're about 24 minutes away from 2 p.m. rather. And at last check, I think we needed 50 additional contributions. There's thousands of you listening right now, tens of thousands, I believe. This is easy if a few of you will take action and do this for us. But 50 is a lot. So we would ask that you, if you've been waiting and thinking, oh, I'll get to it after I send this email, after I, finish eating. Oh, I'm sorry, we need 45. We would ask that you do it now. $1,000 extra in addition to your contribution is a big deal for us. You can help us out now, and we appreciate your taking on responsibility for KERA by going online to make a contribution at kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. Hello, Justin Martin.
Hello, Chris. Think listeners, now is the time to show your support. If you've been waiting for perhaps the right moment to give a call into the station at 1-888-694-6931, I'd say now is an excellent time. We have the $1,000 challenge grant from Wells Fargo Foundation. We're looking at needing 45 more contributors at whatever level. Perhaps you're interested in the sustaining membership, $1 a day, the $365 level, $90, $35, $400, whatever works best for you, goes directly to supporting the program and goes directly to keeping Think with Chris Boyd on the air, and allows us to bring you these really compelling topics that have you glued to your radio, whether you be in the car, at work, or you're listening online now through KERA.org. But the important part of this is to take a couple of minutes out of your afternoon and call 1-888-694-6931. Help us achieve this $1,000 challenge from the Wells Fargo Foundation. You can do that online at KERA.org also.
Average annual contribution is a little over $100. Whatever amount you want to give is up to you. But if you want to make a $120 contribution, you can receive a copy of Barry Schwartz's book, Practical Wisdom, as a thank you gift. We would love to be able to offer that to you. So you can just go online to kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931. Thank you so much to Peter and Donna Dulong in Dallas, Paul Sampson and Martha Fellhauer Sampson in Terrell, Tony Lampe in Grand Prairie, and all of you who are helping us to to earn this challenge grant. Thank you to Tom Walters in Dallas, Bart Tindall and Pat Tindall in Grapevine, and Stephen Freeland in Dallas.
1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Again, the number to call, which you should be calling, is 1-888-694-6931 or kera.org. We have all these excellent programs on the air because of your contributions. You hear Sam Baker in the morning with Morning Edition, Terry Gross with Fresh Air, Diane Rehm Show, This American Life, Radiolab. So many excellent programs, and they are all on the air because of your contribution at whatever level you can afford, in conjunction with the other contributions, helps us pay the bills. And with this $1,000 challenge grant in play from the Wells Fargo Foundation, it's really urgent that you take just a couple of minutes and call 1-888-694-6931. We would love to read your name on the air, or you can go to kera.org.
We still need 43 contributions by the end of this hour. That's 21 minutes. Those contributions go to kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. You can receive at the $120 level a copy of Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing by Barry Schwartz. We think the right way to do the right thing for this station that you value, that you love, that you count on, that honestly you probably quote several times a day to the people in your life, is to make a financial contribution. You can break this up if you want into a sustaining membership, and then even a membership at $120 or $240 or $360 becomes really affordable when just a little bit is taken out of your account each month and moved into the KERA membership account.
When you contribute at the basic level of just $35, that gets you the KERA member rewards card. You get tickets early, access to certain events. All sorts of wonderful things are associated with that. Keep in mind also that your contribution to the station is tax deductible, and it goes to a really good cause. 1-888-694-6931 or kera.org.
Thank you so much, Kelly Pino in Denton, Mark and Melissa Reljack in Burleson, Anthony and Ganilla Boland in Highland Village. Thanks to all of you. Also, thank you also to Stephanie Southern Moore in Fort Worth, Sue Watkins in Rowlett, Mary Grunbaum in Dallas, and Linda Pack in Plano. We would love to read your name next. We would love to realize your contribution, and we would love to be able to tell Wells Fargo, yes, we met our goal, our challenge of 75 contributions during the 2 hours of Think Today. Your contribution right now online or on the phone at 1-888-694-6931 takes us that much closer. We really are in that point where your contribution is likely at this point to spur on two or three more people, and we might just get there. So we'd ask for your help now. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Barry Schwartz. He's professor of social theory and social action at Swarthmore College and author of the new book Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. Promised we would get to more phone calls this time in, and we'll speak with Nathaniel now in Flower Mound. Hi, Nathaniel.
Howdy. I wanted to comment on your characterization of modern morality earlier and its connection to Judge Forer's ruling in that criminal case. I think that the real indictment against the more draconian sentence that was eventually given to Michael is that it kind of reveals our reliance on like a procedural justice as opposed to a true thoughtful justice, like your guest is supporting. I don't think it's really an indictment against the black and white worldview and, you know, one of objective morality per se, but I agree that the idea that hard and fast rules can determine the right moral choice in, like, every situation is incorrect. But, I mean, I still don't think it's really an indictment against objective morality.
Well, thanks very much for your call. Do you want to respond to that, Barry?
Well, I think it's not an indictment against objective morality. I think it's an indictment against the notion that even objective moral decisions have clear, bright lines, clear right and wrong, clear black and white. And I think it's very much about developing procedures that everyone will follow
so you can't be accused of showing partiality. Treat everyone alike. You know, that's the way to be fair. That's the way to be just. The trouble is that you really shouldn't treat everyone alike. As a teacher, you should find out what each of your children in your class needs and give each child what he or she needs, not treat every child alike. And when we see teachers doing that, it's right away they're playing favorites, it isn't fair, blah, 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 what about my kid? And so they retreat to, you know, treat everyone alike, and then no one can accuse them of favoritism.
What's interesting about that is that anyone who's ever raised more than one child knows that the treat everyone alike just doesn't work from day one.
Exactly. I mean, that's the weird thing. People know in their personal lives that you don't treat all your kids alike. You don't treat all your friends alike. And yet when it comes to the way they expect the institutions that they depend on to work, schools, healthcare, whatever, then all of a sudden they think the way they should work is that you treat everyone alike. It doesn't work for your family, and it's not going to work for patients. It's not going to work for lawyers' clients either.
Well, let me ask you this, Barry. Very few people would argue that we certainly need a set of pretty well-delineated rules and laws. How then can we make sure, when we are making the things that we think ought to apply to just about everybody, that we make good decisions about what they include?
Oh, it's very, very hard. It takes wisdom to know when to let wisdom operate.
Hmm.
So in the case, say, of banking, the almost complete catastrophe of the American financial system in the last few years is in no small measure because we did away with rules that regulated the kinds of things banks could do. And enthusiasts of free market competition kept on insisting, take those rules away, let banks make whatever investments they think are going to be profitable, and everyone will be better off. And they nearly brought the entire house down. So we need rules. The mistake is to think that you could ever craft rules that in and of themselves will do the job. Bankers are smart people, bankers and, you know, people in the financial world in general. And as soon as you lay down a set of clear and concrete rules, they will, if they are of a mind to, find a way around them. So what you need is not just rules which work as guidelines, but you also need for bankers to have character, for bankers to actually want to do the right thing, to serve clients, to serve the public good, while at the same time being profitable. And you're not going to get character by coming up with a set of rules.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Patrick in Plano. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As I understand Dr. Schwartz's position, so we if we're going to act appropriately or morally, we need to stay away from rules. So my question is, does he intend to resist the idea that whenever we make a decision, we have some internalized set of rules, or what exactly does he think is going on when it comes to moral psychology? Is there internalized set of rules or not?
I'll leap in and say, Barry, you're not saying that we should never follow the rules. Am I correct?
I'm not saying we should never follow the rules. And the second thing is, I think it's very hard to develop judgment without rules as guidelines. So one way of thinking about rules is that they're kind of like training wheels when you're learning to ride a bicycle. You need them to get yourself started. But eventually, you develop all of the subtle nuanced adjustments that it takes to keep your balance, and the training wheels can come off. You need to erect a kind of scaffolding as you're constructing a building. But when the building's walls are strong enough to support the structure, you can take the scaffolding down. So rules are a kind of scaffolding that get us in the right region to figure out the right thing to do. And then the wiser we become, the less important these rules are, whether they are social legal rules or the kind of internal moral rules that that Patrick had in mind.
In your experience, does a wise person always have the ability to explain why he or she deviated from a hard and fast rule to make a better decision?
Well, the answer to that, I think, is probably no. It is often the case that we come instantly to an answer to the question, how should I talk to my friend or how should I treat this student, and we don't know where this answer comes from. It pops into our heads.
And our explanation of this, backed up by a fair amount of research now in psychology, is that what practice does is it makes certain kinds of responses to situations automatic. That is, we can immediately recognize a pattern, a complicated pattern, without knowing how we recognize the pattern. So a skilled chess player sees a pattern on the chessboard that a novice can't see. What happens with us, I think, when it comes to making moral decisions, is that we see a pattern in the friend we're talking to, and what Luke saw, the hospital custodian, when he was dealing with the father, is he saw a pattern in the facial expression of the father's tone of voice, that told him this is a situation that calls for kindness, and he did it. So it feels automatic, and we probably have very little access to the particular features of the situation that tell us what to do once we've actually acquired the kind of skill that wisdom requires.
Did you hear that story? I think it was last week about a Southwest Airlines pilot that held at the gate so that the grandfather of a dying child could get on the plane.
Actually, somebody who's read our book sent me that. I hadn't heard about that story, but he sent it to me because he thought, here's an example of practical wisdom in action. And, you know, isn't it nice to feel that you have permission from your employer to do something like that? I think an awful lot of people feel like they're working in an environment where they just have to follow the script. They have to do what they're told. They can't use their judgment, and they'll get slapped down if they try. And it looks like, at least at Southwest, judgment on the part of employees to serve customers is encouraged.
Do you find that people respond to this book and to the conversations that you've had over the years in a different way, depending on where they are in their lives, what age they are, for example?
Absolutely. We say that wisdom, as you said starting the show, we suggest that everyone is capable of practical wisdom, but it requires experience. You have to learn it. Mm-hmm. And so what we find is that the older people are, the more sympathetic they are to the story we're telling. It's very hard to convince the college students we teach that whatever it is they need, they don't already have. and you know, people with a little less hair on their heads and hair that's sort of gray and white might actually have something to teach them. But I think we succeed over the course of a whole semester, not in making our college students wise, but at least in making them see how important it is to become wise in your work and in your relations with friends and with your romantic partners.
I guess that's half the battle right there.
It is.
Barry Schwartz, it's been a pleasure to have you on this hour. Barry Schwartz is professor of social theory and social action at Swarthmore College. His new book, written with Kenneth Sharp, is called Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. Barry, thank you so much for spending this hour with
us. Thank you so much, Chris. It's really been a pleasure.
It's been great to have all of you listening to the show this hour. We are working on our challenge. We have about 6.5 minutes left to go. We have 35 contributions in order to receive a $1,000 challenge grant. This is an additional gift that we would receive from the Wells Fargo Foundation if we promised that we would get a total of 75 contributions during the 2 hours of Think. Have 35 to go. We have the phone and online capacity to take your contribution right now in any amount, but only you have the capacity to take action and do it. We would ask you, please, if you've been considering making a contribution or an additional gift, that you you think about doing that now, because it will really help. You can go on the phones to 1-888-694-6931 or go online at kera.org.
Show your support for Think, 1-888-694-6931, online at kera.org. This Wells Fargo Foundation challenge is a significant amount of money. It's $1,000. It's one large step closer to wrapping up this membership campaign and going back to normal programming. I need more coffee. 1-888-694-6931. Or you can go online to kera.org. Contribute at whatever level you can afford in conjunction with the other contributions. We can reach this goal, which is what we want to do. We want to say congratulations. We reached the goal. It's an additional $1,000. But the only way to get there is if you take just a couple of minutes and dial 1-888-694-6931. Or you can go online to kera.org.
I will say, Justin, you never sound less than fully caffeinated. or over-caffeinated. Regardless of your caffeine level, your support of this station really matters and allows us to work for you. The money that you send goes to work for you and for the community. You get to hear it every single day. I can't think of a good reason why you wouldn't want to support the radio station that you count on and that you want to be strong and continue serving your favorite programs. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also make a contribution at KERA.org. Just to reiterate, the challenge on the table from the Wells Fargo Foundation is for $1,000. That's a big deal. That's a lot of money for us. Your contribution, be it $10 or $100 or $1,000, is one more contribution toward the $75 we need to have by the end of this hour in order to claim that challenge grant. We really can't take the money unless we get to what we promised we would do. And so your contribution right now will put us that much closer.
1-888-694-6931 or KERA.org. As Chris was saying, if we don't meet the number, we can't accept the money from the Wells Fargo Foundation. We kind of have to say goodbye to that. We don't want to do that. And it's completely doable. There are thousands of listeners, not just online, but anywhere in the Metroplex right now that are tuning in. And we need you to call 1-888-694-6931 or online at KERA.org. Show your support for public radio here in North Texas for compelling programs like Think that make you think and perhaps add a little bit a better understanding of what's going on around in the world. 1-888-694-6931, online at KERA.org.
Don't wait for someone else to do the right thing. Do the right thing yourself for your radio station. Thank you so much. We need 29. We need an additional 29 contributions.
So
William and Putin Nix in Fort Worth have done their part. Thank you so much. Thanks to Stephen and Yannick Rovinsky in Plano. Thank you, Brian Kost in Coppell and Martha Hoffmeister in Dallas. We know we do have folks on the phone now. If you initiate a call or initiate an online transaction and the sort of the time comes up, we should be able to count that. But I would hope that you're not waiting to hear that it's, you know, if you're waiting to hear that we're down to the final 10 or 5, it might be too late. So we would really ask that you take action now so that KERA stays strong. 1-888-694-6931. The thing that makes me craziest, Justin, is when we get within like 2 or 3 when we have to walk away from it. And sometimes you do this because you're waiting and you think, well, if they really need it, if they're down to like 2 people and it's the very last second, then I'll call or then I'll go online. And often that it doesn't work.
We are so very close. As Chris was saying, sometimes you can get into the system. It will, if it processes before the next hour, it'll be added to the goal. So please do your part. 1-888-694-6931. Consider for a moment, I said this earlier, how long KERA has served as your audio oasis on the radio dial. Show your support for public broadcasting in North Texas. We're a community-based organization. We live and work here, and we want to improve the situation. 1-888-694-6931. Online at KERA.org.
We are getting close here. Thank you to Ben Montaigne in Cleburne, Shane Waddell in Dallas, Eleanor and John Birch in Dallas, Mark Howell in Wichita Falls. Their contributions are getting us closer to that total of 75 so that we can receive the $1,000 from the Wells Fargo Foundation. Thank you, Leticia Rodriguez in Fort Worth, Janice Williamson in Arlington, Dorothea Lee in Flower Mound. And if you have finally been, okay, we have 28 contributions.
So close.
27 contributions. I feel like I'm calling an auction here.
Yes. there
is capacity in our system to take all those contributions. So please don't think, well, it's too late for me now. It's definitely not. Thank you, Deborah and David Fostick in Dallas, Lee Huber in Rockwall, and Ann Laporta in Addison.
Addison, 1-888-694-6931. Would love to read your name on the air. Or, of course, you can always go to KERA.org. It's safe. It's secure. It's fast. It goes a long way to supporting public radio here in North Texas. We've been on the air for about 37 years. We're about the community here in North Texas. We know you enjoy listening, and it's been your dollars that's allowed KERA to provide you with the quality of programming that you rely on. 1-888-694-6931, online at KERA.org.
We are down into the last minute or two of time where we are taking these in. If you initiate your call or go online in time, we should be able to count that toward the thing, but we're close. We have, at last count, I think it was 26 contributions left to make.
So close.
Possible. It's possible. There could be, at this moment, 25 other people, and you might be number 26, the one who makes it happen for a $1,000 challenge grant from the Wells Fargo Foundation, please go online now to KERA.org or call 1-888-694-6931.
Every contribution counts towards this challenge, but whether you can afford $90, whether you're comfortable with $120.
We're at 20 now.
Just 20.
We can do it.
1-888-694-6931. Again, this is $1,000 from the Wells Fargo Foundation that's at this challenge right now, and we are so very close to meeting it. So please consider for a moment how much public radio means to not just you, but your community. 1-888-694-6931 or KERA.org.
Your contribution happens because you believe public radio is important and necessary and that it contributes something to your life. If you disagree with that, I'd be surprised because you're listening, you love the station. We know that you love public radio. We know that you support KERA. You want it to do well. Why not support it with your dollars at 1-888-694-6931 or online at KERA.org. Thank you.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.